right, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Fire Builders Live. My name is Josh Korpel, and like always, I'm streaming from the porch, Key West, Florida. And guess who I have on the show? Back on the show, season two, Tatiana Sawyer. Welcome to Fire Builders Live.
Thanks, Josh.
This is so good to have you back. We had a great conversation before. We're going round two, baby. And what we're going to be talking about today is something that I think everybody needs to pay attention to, particularly if they have their own product or service. It's all about pricing psychology, and we will talk about that in a moment. But first, before we go into all of the craziness of today's episode, let me tell you a little bit about what we do here on Fire Builders Live. We stream live Monday through Saturday, six amazing guests per week, and we bring people on. We take these big ideas, these big goals, kind of like pricing psychology. We break it down into small steps, things that you can focus on and that you can do every day to progress, because it's that continuation, right? It's that continuation of action that will actually get you there. That's going to be the key to your success. Let's talk a little bit about who Tatiana is. You might recognize her from season one, but if you don't know who she is, let me tell you: author, podcast host, CPA with over 15 years of experience in helping entrepreneurs kind of control their finances, get it all buckled down, right? Know their numbers, right? Today, knowing how to price your product, because over the years, Tatiana has just, you know, she's noticed the same questions come up over and over again about how to actually price products and price psychology. Pricing model do I use, right? How do I research price? You overprice certain things, potential customers might run away. You underprice, people might get the wrong impression that your stuff is too cheap, and we don't want that. And that is why I am so excited to have Tatiana back on the show. Tatiana, welcome again to Fire Builders Live.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's going to be good. It's going to be good. So I'll tell you what, for those of you who do not know who you are, this is the first time that they're here. Where are you in the world? What's a typical Tatiana day like these days?
So I'm in a suburb of New York City, and we love it here. And a typical day is actually very atypical compared to traditional CPAs. I actually work about 2 days a week, 2-3 days a week on my main business. And then the other 2-3 days a week, I work creating trainings and writing, editing my book and different other things. So a typical day could range from talking to clients all day, which is usually my Mondays, to doing some sales tax work, which is what I've been doing today, and then recording some videos for some trainings that I'm launching too. So it's a little crazy.
I never knew. Like, we talked a little while ago and you showed me how many trainings you actually have, like, back end. I had no idea how much stuff you, I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you do it. It's incredible. You have so much amazing material. So I would imagine, like, your day is pretty packed with recording videos and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so you started as a CPA, and did you gradually realize that you like working with people, but it wasn't your main focus? You liked working with entrepreneurs and you started moving in that direction for both them and yourself?
So I actually started out as a bookkeeper, and I was forced to work with a couple of clients in the beginning, as opposed to working, you know, full time for a company, because I wanted to finish college before there was a cutoff where they were changing rules for the CPA license. So I ended up finding five small businesses to work with and do bookkeeping for. So like a day a week or 2 days a week or half a day or whatever. And that kind of introduced me to this world of being an entrepreneur. I didn't realize I was an entrepreneur back then, but I worked with small businesses and I did everything, you know, in terms of creating invoices, entering bills, paying their vendors, receiving payments, reconciling and everything. And then
all the fun stuff, all the fun stuff.
Yeah. Fun stuff.
quote unquote.
Yeah. So, and then I graduated, started taking the exam. I graduated in the middle of a recession, 2008. Nobody was hiring. So I kept my clients and kept, you know, sitting for the exam. So I passed the exam, found a tax job and learned a lot of the tax knowledge and kind of nitty-gritty tax processing stuff. And as I grew over the years, you know, a couple of years after I started working for this company, I quit and started my own company. I already had experience and a couple of clients on the side. So this was completely, you know, not new to me. And then a couple of years ago, I came across this training on price psychology, and the first module just blew my mind. And I was like, oh my God, I want to do this better. I want to help people price their products and services better. And I apply it to my own firm as well. So that's kind of how that whole thing happened.
The price psychology, the things that you were doing, that's what I love about price psychology, is because it's certainly math, it's statistics, it's understanding the numbers for sure, but it's also really diving deep into human behavior and the psychology behind it, which I would imagine is somewhat different than like a lot of the tax background that you had, right? Because there's doesn't seem like there's very much psychology in that at all. It's like straight black and white, like this is what you can and can't do, maybe some gray areas. But with the price psychology stuff, it's a little softer. And that's what I think is so interesting about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Price psychology is fascinating. And, you know, some people may think that it's when you know price psychology and when you apply it to your business that you're deceiving people, but it's actually not true at all. The goal of price psychology is to make sure that when you know how people behave and how they make purchasing decisions, that they're comparing apples to apples when they are looking at your product. And also when they see your price, that price doesn't seem higher than it is in their brain. That's the goal of price psychology.
Like for instance, by comparison, you know, you position something that you think is like a pretty decent price against something that is a really high price. And that is because people kind of like judge value on comparison.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so then how then does one start to go about this process? Like, what's the most common question that you get when you're dealing with how to price a product?
It's actually the most common thing that happens is that I don't get questions on that.
Is it because people just think they price it based on their own interpretation of how valuable it is, which I would imagine is a way to do it?
I guess it is a way to do it. And what I want to tell you is that pretty much every professional, accountants, attorneys, doctors, and other people, creatives, everyone has a question, how much do I charge? And different people typically approach it either by asking peers or by asking those who are already kind of advanced in the same industry, in the same field. That's what I did. When I quit the accounting firm, I kept in touch with a mentor from the firm, and I asked him, how much do I charge? But, you know, what he shared with me was set me up to become a traditional CPA firm, which is what I now understand was not my goal and will not ever be my goal. But that's the typical approach, kind of what is everybody else charging? How do I compete? But I think that if you kind of dive deeper into price psychology, you'll realize that it's not about competition as much. And if you want, I can expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, so it's not necessarily about what everybody else is charging. And that's what you mean by competition?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because price psychology rests or starts from the fundamental approach. And the fundamental approach is you have to pick a camp. And many companies, many businesses and business owners never realize which camp they belong to. And the two camps are the low cost, the low price leadership. And the second one is the high value differentiation. So the low price leadership, you know, we all know these companies. It's the IKEAs of the world, the Southwest Airlines of the world. And their only competition point is price. Everybody else who is in a high value differentiation, it's all about highlighting or emphasizing a certain value that potential customer might want or look for. And when you think about kind of companies that compete, the Walmarts of the world too, they all kind of feel the same. It's all about the price. So, if you want a budget item or service or whatever, you know that these companies have the cheapest ones. And when everybody else who's in the high value camp kind of differentiates based on a different metric or a different value. You can get a computer for $300, but there is a reason why Apple is making millions and billions of dollars on computers, because they differentiate on a certain value. They appeal to a certain demographic, a certain public mindset, or whatever it may be. When I presented this topic at some point at a college, I asked the students, what is the proper price for car wash? And, there are a couple of different numbers thrown at me. There was the $15, there was the $70, there was something like $80, $90, but that was kind of the top number that I've heard. And I said, well, listen, there are certainly the $15 car washes. That's what I usually get as an everyday, not everyday, but let's say a regular.
Like that's how much, that's basically how much people in their mind say, yeah, you know, I'd shell out $15 for a car wash.
Yeah, exactly. But then once a year, I do a detailing for my my cars because, kids make it a mess in the wintertime. So I would like to be nicer and stuff. So the detailing on my car is like $150 to $180. So that's already a range from $15 to $180. Now, do you think that the $5,000 car wash exists? Absolutely, yes.
Does it actually exist?
It does. It does. Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah. And it's for people who, let's say, buy a Ferrari or a Lamborghini car, and, they spend millions of dollars in these cars. Do you think for them to pay $5,000 for a car wash is a big deal? You know, when someone pays attention to everything in your car, takes good care of it, it's pennies for them. So there's that range, $15 to $5,000, that it's just for the car wash. And it's the same for every product. Now, there are businesses who don't really know what they are, and that's where they get into trouble. Mm. So the first thing that I usually teach in one of the trainings on price psychology, I say, pick a camp. Do you want to compete on price, or do you want to differentiate yourself based on something else? And that's why I said that there's no real competition if you compete on value.
Is it a situation, because if you were just to present that to me and you say, all right, Josh, pick a camp, and I'd say, well, do I want to create a low priced product that has maybe the same amount of value, but it's just because the price is lower, it has this inherent quality of being more inexpensive, right? Or do I want to create something that has higher value? I also feel like the other question to say in that is, do I want to spend more like time and money acquiring more and more customers, right, to offset that low price? Or do I want to spend my time, like, it may take a year for me to find that $5,000 person for the car wash, but is it time better spent for the money, because I'm making so much more with one sale?
And that's why I said, pick a camp. That's exactly what the process should be. And here's the thing, there's no good or bad when it comes to that, because they're like Southwest Airlines, they realize that their highest expenses are when the plane is on the ground. The plane makes money when it's in the air. Baggage stuff related. So they actually invested in a system where the luggage gets unloaded quickly. And they don't do perks on the plane. So, and they also do regional airports. So they've picked a demographic of people, not demographic, I guess, area of, or the word is escaping me, of people, a group of people who value regional airports, quick and frequent departures, no perks and no luggage, because that's business people. And they targeted that specific demographic, and they created low cost plane tickets for them. So they're making were making a ton of money before the pandemic hit. They were making a ton of money competing on price alone. But you have to know that when you pick this camp, your goal is to cut costs. If you want to grow, the two things that come with it is high volume and consistently trying to cut costs whenever, wherever and whenever possible.
Yeah. 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 No, no. Keep going. And like, this is the best, because you're right. Like I read somewhere about Southwest where they have one like mantra, you know, that they just instill in every one of their employees. They say, look, we are the low cost airline. Like, we are it. There is no one else. So every question that you have about, should we do this? Should we do that? Should we offer peanuts? Should we, should we try and fit another row of seats in? Like, I mean, whatever questions they have, they would weigh it against that mantra. And they would say, well, if we do this, does it make us the low cost airline? And that kind of, that mentality guided them into making a better decision overall amongst all of the things that they could possibly do.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like I said, there's no good or bad strategy. You just have to have an actual strategy. You know, certainly the businesses that focus on low prices exist and are highly profitable in many cases. Now, the high value differentiation is a different business. And you have to understand whether you are high value. And it doesn't mean that you're expensive. It just means that you focus on, you're maybe priced higher than the Walmarts of the world, but the reason is because you have a higher quality, or there's a customer experience, or you provide guidance or holistic approach to a business like I do. And certainly you would create a vision or develop your vision for your business based on that, and make sure that you weigh decisions that you make, just like you do in a low cost leadership. You would weigh it against that mantra for yourself. What are you? What kind of company are you? Like Starbucks, it's a third place. That was the mantra kind of for when the Starbucks founder founded the company. He came back from Italy. He was, obsessed with the little coffee shops, because between the work and the home, that's where people would go to like spend time and relax and listen to the music or do whatever. It's their third place. So, and Starbucks is not.
Oh man, when you said third place, I thought you were talking about like they were going to be the third place spot in the leaders of coffee. You're talking about like it's like the way that we say second home, right? It's their, it's like, it's the place that they just feel comfortable. Okay. I got it.
Yeah. So definitely there's, you know, there's psychology behind all of these strategies. And as long as you have a vision and a strategy and know who you are, that's how you can grow and scale your business and make it the business that you wanted to be.
Well, when you said that for a low cost, like if you're going to compete on price, if that's the camp that you have decided, your number one goal or goals should be to cut costs, right, as much as possible and get the highest volume of sales that you possibly can. How does that change if you're a high value company? What are your goals then?
Your goals are to make sure that the customer gets an experience, whether it's an actual experiential event or let's say if you're a cosmetics company and if you're a higher end cosmetics company, you want the packaging to be beautiful and high quality and really maintain what you said you would. So if I am, Dior, and I create eyeshadows for women, you know, when you buy a Dior, it's really well packaged. You don't feel like it's cheap. There's high quality ingredients. There's high quality packaging. It's beautiful. It's one of a kind, whatever. So when you are a high value, you focus on creating something that solves someone's problem besides the price. And also gives them something, a feeling of whether it's, you know, I'm driving off the road in a Land Rover or whatever. And also, so you focus on not the volume. Yes, you would, for a product company, you would want to sell more, but you focus on incorporating a healthy profit into the price, so that if you sell less, you still make a great amount of money.
Yep. I dig it. I think here, let me pull up, Lyndon says niche client targeting to the max. I feel like that's right. I mean, once you, if you can focus in on one particular very, very clear subset of people that you know, not only can you solve their problem, but you could do it so well, right? Where you really can create more of a high quality experience for people. And I agree, like, you know, because it's kind of like, it's not necessarily the product or service itself. It's everything that surrounds it. You know, it's the lifestyle that surrounds it. Take Southwest, though. You know, they said, no, you know, like, we don't really, of course, it's important, the situation, the environment, everything that surrounds the idea of flying from, you know, here to Vegas. But that's not the main thing. The main thing is that you know that you're getting a deal because on price, like, you're doing it for the least amount. But like you're saying, if you create great packaging and a fantastic experience and show people how to use it, right, and make it as smooth as possible to incorporate that product or service into their life, then you can really start to crank up the price because you're starting to become that second camp high value person.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a great example of how it can apply or illustrate the concept is traditional accounting firms. You know, so many accountants still are in that camp of, you know, people are bargaining with me for $50 or for $100 or whatever. And the accountants are actually doing it to themselves because they say, well, you know, I have to compete with other professionals. The reality is that, and this is the research that my husband has done years ago, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, is that there is statistically 700 clients per a tax accountant. Now, that means that there's enough work for everyone, and you have to decide for yourself, do you want to cram 700 clients in that 3 month period of the year? Or do you want to work with less like I do? I work, you know, I want to work with a lot less clients, but have a more meaningful relationship with them, give them more value, help them grow, and not just get their taxes filed.
Do you find that your approach in finding those people is any different? Like, how do you go out and knowing that, like, how do you go out and find those people that you want, that you know are like craving the peace of mind of having a very high touch, high value experience for their taxes?
So my business is typically a word of mouth referral. And I also, I'm a part of the Profit First group, Profit First Professionals. And because of that, you know, I have people reaching out to me as to a Profit First Professional. But I think that it's, like, what I offer to them, first of all, I explain how I work, that it's not just a one and done type relationship, that in a traditional accounting firm, especially if an accountant has 200-300 clients, you may think that you're getting, you know, all this service, tax advice and tax strategies, but you really aren't. January through April 15th, the only goal is to file everybody on time, not forget everybody, anybody, not miss anything. Make sure that the clients who pay enough so that there's no penalty and all of that. So there's nobody's taking a second look at anything in your business. It's already too late anyway, because the year is over. That happens throughout the year, not, you know, at the end of it.
Yeah, exactly. And let that be, you know, everybody that's listening right now, take heed to that, you know, like, listen, because you're right. So many, I know a lot of people that just wait until the last minute and then expect, right, that they're going to find all of these amazing kind of tax breaks and things at the very, but you're right. It's like, how can you guys, the tax accountant, how can you actually handle that volume? You can't, you just can't.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I do want to bring this up because I think this is a good question. Lynn asked, how much do you believe that higher pricing equates to perceived value through the client's eyes?
So I'll give you an example, and I saw the question, and I'll give you an example when it comes to accounting firms, because that's something that's near and dear to me. But it's not just about the higher pricing. You're not justifying the price to the client. I'm not justifying my price to the client. What I tell them and talk to them is how much, what I can do for them, how I can help them grow, how I can help hold their hand and get their bookkeeping done, get their reconciliations done, help them understand what the numbers mean to them, and then incorporate tax strategies throughout the year for them so that they're actually paying less taxes when it's tax time. I hate surprises too. I don't like to deliver bad news in March or April. Oh, you owe 50 grand or 100 grand or whatever. So that's why we work together throughout the year so that you know exactly what's happening in your business and how much taxes you're paying and so on and so forth. Now, price psychology comes into it, but when the price psychology concepts are what help us make sure that the value that we communicate to the client, to the customer, potential customer, match what the price is. Because I'll give you an example. There's this woman who's selling software products, and it's $300. Now, I know how valuable the software is, but the $300 seems like a lot per month. And instead, I wanted to reach out to her and tell her, listen, presented as $297. In my brain, it seems like it's a little lower and it's not as intimidating of a number as $300 even is.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like it just bumps it up another mental tier in your mind, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is why you see all of the like sevens and, you know, the like $47 and $299.97 and stuff like that. Yeah. Yeah. But do you think then, so if you're not, cause I agree, like when it comes to price, especially something that's high value, you want to explain to customers what it means, right? Like not necessarily what it is. Yes. This is an accounting service that is going to cost you $5,000, right? Whatever you end up charging. But that's just what it is. And we could spend time looking at what it is, but let's talk about what it means. What it means is that you don't have to worry about this, this, and this. You don't have to stress out about this. And you know, at the end of the year, things will be taken care of. And if money is truly just a tool to solve problems, it is solving your problem in a huge, huge way.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. And when it comes to my service, I mean, there are two components to it, at least in my firm. One is the actual getting the work done component, which you could potentially be a competitive, you know, point of competition. But then there is this experience, knowledge, training, and approach component where I help you, I coach you, we set goals together. We talk about these goals. Do they make sense? Do the investments make sense from a tax perspective and from a business perspective? All of those questions are arbitrary, and it's me working with you throughout the year. And when it comes to tax strategies, another component of the service, it's how much money it saves you. So in most cases, actually in all of the cases where I work with clients in that manner, they save much more money during the year that covers not only my fees, but gives them premium on that too.
Yeah, like a little bit of extra money to burn during Black Friday, you know, kind of thing. Well, as people, so what I like to ask people on this show is, right, suggesting that they do one thing. And maybe that one thing is in a quest to figure out what camp they're in, because I like that a lot. Like that's really the first step. I don't know. So how do you suggest that people go about that in their minds? How do they wrestle the pros and cons? What have you seen in your experience?
So we haven't really talked a lot about price psychology yet, which we can. I can give you some basics if you'd like. But when it comes to pricing your product or service, first of all, you know, when it's a service, we follow the menu pricing approach. When it's a product, we follow an upsell strategy approach. But something that people can do every day is test and change. Because if something's selling out, that means that the price is low and maybe you should raise it. But being clear on what it is that you are realigning with your vision for your business, and testing your prices every day or every month or whatever regularly is something that will help you create a business that's highly profitable and allows you to have the life that you want for yourself too.
Well, okay. So tactical question about that, because I agree with you testing, like, man, I come from an engineering background, right? So I'm like, yeah, but testing your pricing, if you're switching around your pricing all the time, that actually can start to conflict, right? Where you know, you're sending out mixed messages to people. What do you do? Do you start low and slowly work your way up? Because what if you talk to somebody and you say, yep, I'm charging $500 an hour. And then you talk to somebody else and you say, no, I'm charging $250 an hour. And then those two people like meet each other on the street, you know? How do you suggest that they get around to those like kind of sticky issues?
So before I can answer that, if you don't mind, I'll provide some background and in some general basic items in price psychology. So when you're pricing a service, it has been statistically proven to be true. You should use menu pricing. Three packages has been found to be ideal. And the reason is that when you have more than three, people are confused, too many choices. When you have less than three, people feel like they're kind of limited. They're kind of boxed in. And three options is usually best. So by creating three options, three different price levels, you basically have an offer for different income levels, or I can afford this levels of people. So there are certainly people who want to work with you but can't afford to buy your most expensive package. But maybe they can get a starter package and grow and develop and bring more money in and then upgrade later. Or maybe not. Maybe they'll stay at that lowest package for a while. But there are always those people who want the best of the best, no matter what. They want the most expensive package. So why wouldn't you create an offer that appeals to them? Now, statistically speaking, 60% of people will buy your middle package. And that is useful information because that tells you that you want to create a middle package that's valuable and that's priced with your profit in mind, because you're going to be selling mostly that package. So you need to make sure that not only your overhead is covered, your variable costs are covered, but also that you have a nice profit that works for you, that makes it worth your while.
And I would imagine that like percentage of profit kind of varies depending on what you're comfortable with, how much risk you're willing to take, what product costs you have, like cost of goods sold, all of that kind of fits in. For you, like for the people that you work with, do you typically actually work with people that do physical products or services?
Both.
Or a little bit of both?
A lot of both, yeah. For products, menu pricing is a little tricky, meaning that you can't always have a different level. I have a clothing client who serves a certain demographic, or I guess a certain psychographic of people. And the way he approached menu pricing just recently was to create a core product, an entry package into the brand. And that you can call your lowest package. But like Apple, for example, they don't do menu pricing as much. But what they do is a series of upsells. So you start with the lowest computer. Oh, I can afford a $1,200 computer. Great. And then you pick a computer, you add it to your cart, and then Apple knows you're in the buying mode, which means that now everything else that they offer to you that's lower in price seems much lower. And that's, it's called an anchor, another price psychology term. But they know, so they offer you an upgrade to your display, an upgrade to your hard drive, your, I don't know, RAM or whatever. And then you end up with a $2,500 computer in your cart. And then you already are attached to that computer. So for a product business, the approach is slightly different, but it still is a psychological approach. Now, product businesses, when it comes to actual numbers, the companies mostly, and we all know that they're doing this, but they mostly use this left digit management technique, which basically, if something you want to sell something at $300, you price it at $299. Because it does, and it does work on me as well. Like it's, you know, and my husband asked
me too.
How much it costs. It's like, oh, it's 200. When it's really three. But think about it. When you see 300 versus 299, psychologically, you feel like the 300 is much higher, even though it's superficial. It's not real. You still feel that it's higher. So you may be turned away where it's really 300, 299, something that you could afford. I mean, it's still rounded up, but seeing that number makes you feel like it's much higher. For the service industry, software and service industry, it's slightly different. And that's where number seven comes into play. It's called the power of seven. And what it means is that, you know, as an accountant, for example, I now work on monthly installments. So there is a price for the year. And then to make it easier for people, they pay every month. So it's a monthly kind of payment. Now, when a client goes and talks to a traditional accountant and they give them, I don't know, $10,000 or some price for the year, and they come back to me and they look at my prices for the month, they're comparing apples to oranges. So the power of seven comes in handy because, interestingly enough, when people look at the price ending in nine, and it's a monthly price or three installments or five installments, they round it up and they multiply. They do the math. It's easy to do. When it's ending in seven, most people don't. And then they end up comparing the monthly installment in front of them. Can they afford it or can they not afford it? And that's what it comes down to, kind of. That's why, you know, for service industry.
I've never heard that before, but that's sneaky, right? That's sneaky that people, you know, people do if it ends in nine, they do the multiplication in their head if it's like five installments. But if it's seven, they're like, nope, not happening. That's crazy. Huh. Interesting. That's like, if you watch, you know, do you watch QVC or like the Home Shopping Network, and you watch, like, those people are masters at this, you know, with those low installments. And I'm going to see if they do. I bet you they do that exact same thing.
Exactly. And I mean, everybody does it. And the thing is that, can you afford $7 a day or $3 a day computer purchase? That's how, I believe in the UK was advertised, you know, computer that costs less than a cup of Starbucks every day. And then when you end up adding all the features in, it ends up being much more, but you already passed that. You already are in the buying mode. You're ready to do it. You think in your brain, you've justified the purchase.
Well, so if testing is really the thing to do, right, in some way, shape, or form, if people were to try this in some way, you know, start creating packages and testing pricing and get people's reactions and started, right? But they did it consistently, depending on what their product or service is. If they did it consistently over 30 days, in your experience, like, how long does it typically take to really start landing on the perfect like anchor price, essentially?
So, that's actually going back to your initial question, but the testing has to happen. Well, first of all, it depends on whether you're new to this business or, if you've been in business for some time. It's harder when you've been in business for some time, because then you have to test carefully, and you have to test maybe the first 5 to 10% of your customers and see how they respond to the price change. You know, with technology nowadays, it's very easy to do. It's very easy to show a certain pricing, and maybe it's a 10% increase. You know, depending on the amount of money, it may or may not be noticeable to people. But the point is that you do it in chunks and you see how people respond, how they react to it. You talk to them. Now, there are different software packages, and the course that I took, they offered this as a kind of a benefit. Software that could basically help a business estimate how many customers a business can lose if they raise a price, let's say 10%, can afford to lose to preserve the same bottom line. And that's powerful. So you may want to test and see how those numbers play out. How many customers are you losing out of the 10% that you've tested? And is it still worth your while?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, for those that are listening, like, at least coming from the software world, right? For those that are listening, they say to themselves, well, why would you want to raise your prices only to lose customers? For us, like, it actually, you can boil down your costs to how much it costs to close a ticket in customer service. So if you have a lot of customer service requests, it costs you, you could essentially put a number to that and say, yeah, it costs us like $3 per closed ticket. So if you have less tickets that are open because you have less customers, but you're getting the same amount of money, then that ends up being a win for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you focus on servicing clients. So what I've realized for my practice, for example, I realize that I end up spending a lot of time answering quick questions and answering different things to clients. They pay me $1,000 a year. where I have VIP clients who pay me tens of thousands of dollars a year, and I end up setting them aside to answer all these different things. And they're the ones who are really paying me for my time and expertise. So similarly, you know, it could be the same approach can be used in, like you said, a customer service. If you have to service less customers, raise your prices and have less of those customers, wouldn't that be nicer? Wouldn't that be require less effort and less stress and less resources and less risk?
Totally. It ends up for a lot of people, it ends up being a psychological thing, right? Where do they feel comfortable charging that much for their time, essentially? And that's just, I feel like that's just something that you build up over time, you know, that confidence.
Well, it goes a little deeper than just the hourly rate, at least for me, because, you know, there's this story or anecdote or whatever about, you know, a ship mechanic fixing an engine, you know, by knocking in a certain place and then sending a bill for $10,000. And when he was asked for kind of to break down the bill, he says $2 to knock on the engine and then $9,998 to know where to knock. I no longer sell like hourly time because it's not about the time that I spend. It's about access to my brain is what it really comes down to. And it's similar for other professionals.
Totally. Like anybody that's in the done for you space for marketing, like tech and anything that, you know, they're on Fiverr or Upwork or something like that. It's the exact same for them too. It's like you bring so much expertise to the table. And at that point, like most of them, they won't even do an hourly rate. You'll just straight up do it by project and say, nope, it's going to cost you $5,000 to do this whole thing. And it doesn't matter how long it takes. That's what it's going to cost you. And some people are a little bit more comfortable doing it that way. I think it's very smart. I think it's very smart to do it that way. Yeah.
Hey, Josh, so do you mind if I share one last strategy that is probably very useful for people?
Do it.
It's just something that you can use both as a business owner and also as a consumer, kind of keep an eye out for it. It's something called an anchor. And an anchor is a very, very a smart strategy that companies have used for years, for decades. And an anchor is a price, a random number that's presented to you right before a price is revealed for a certain product or service that you're looking at, or maybe you're about to purchase, or just randomly passing by at an airport. So there is a watch company. I forgot what the name is, but it makes expensive watches, not the Rolex, something else. Anyway, they developed a watch that's $1 million. Now, that watch is not for sale. It's displayed at a store or at an airport store or whatever it may be to create an anchor to make everything else that they sell seem cheap or cheaper or less. You know, even if it's a $50,000 watch, it still seems cheaper than the $1 million that's standing right there with diamonds and stuff. So an anchor, you as a business could use it. It's a little bit of a deception, but still, you could use it to create an anchor in people's mind. And Williams Sonoma used a bread maker upgrade to do the same a number of years ago. It's a known experiment. But when you're a consumer, ignore any other prices that are or any other numbers that are presented right before you look at the price or you are presented with the price. You know, like the TJ Maxx's and the Marshalls of the world, they always tell you what the price was for that specific reason. That's an anchor to create an anchor in your brain to make the price seem much less, even if it's a high price.
Well, is that to say then that the number, the anchor number, it doesn't even have to be a price. It can just be any number, like a statistic. Like, we've helped 1 million people do this, this, and this, and it's going to cost you $99. And that's sneaky. That is sneaky.
It is. You know, they did an experiment with the Wheel of Fortune or whatever, and there were only two numbers in that wheel. One was a higher number, and another one was a lower number. And they tested a number of people. They would spin the wheel, and if it was, you know, and then they would ask a person, what do you think X should cost? Something completely unrelated to the wheel. And if the number on the wheel was higher, then the average price that people came up with was higher. So it doesn't even have to be a price that you see. It has to be just some other number, not related, but presented to you close enough to the purchase point.
That's nuts. I've never heard that either. That's crazy. I'm going to look for that. I'm totally looking for that to see if like e-com stores and stuff. That's crazy. Okay. This has been so good. Tatiana, honestly, this is such a cool conversation. Tell everybody. So I know that you've got a book coming out soon, right?
Yeah.
It's going to be great. Like, tell me a little bit about it. Tell everybody listening a little bit about it. And how do they get in touch with you and find out more about it themselves?
So the book is called Dream Bold, Start Smart. And it's available for pre-order on Amazon. And, you know, go ahead and pre-order it. If the book is for someone who wants to be their own boss and make money doing what they love. And it's the basics. It's how to price your product or service, how to set up an entity, the right entity for you, how to manage your cash flow, and a number of other cool things. But if you want to connect and stay in touch with me, go onto my website, talksatatiana.com. Join my email list, follow me on social media, and let's stay in touch.
I love it. And talktotatiana.com is actually linked in the description of this video if you're watching live, or if you're listening on the podcast, it's in the show notes. So you can just click it right there, go straight to her site and check it out. Seriously, Tatiana, it is always so good to talk with you on this. I learn every time that we talk, I learn something new and amazing from you. You're just a wealth of knowledge, really. So this has been great. Well, as we wrap up, you got any parting wisdom for people? What would you like to leave them with as we sort of say adios?
I want to say pick a camp, know who you are, and have a vision. And then you can build a business that creates a life that you want.
There you go. You heard it first. You heard it first. Tatiana, Josh, Elvis, somewhere around here. We are signing off for another episode of Fire Builders Live. Again, we stream live Monday through Saturday, 6 days a week. If you guys liked this, if you like what you see, you should check it out. Elvis wants you to feed him. He needs a cup of coffee in the morning. So you can actually help support the show if you go to firebuilderslive.com. It's got all the information there. You should really check it out. Tatiana, this has been so good. Thank you again for your time.
Thanks so much.
All right. Well, we're signing off, guys. Thanks again. Adios. We will talk to you later. See ya.